Five Hostages. Five American families, each harboring a grave secret, took their seats around a vast dining table at the home of David Bradley, a Washington, D.C. entrepreneur who owns the media company that publishes The Atlantic. It was May 13, 2014, and in the garden, beyond the French doors, where magnolias and dogwoods were in bloom, a tent had been erected for an event that Bradley's wife, Catherine, was hosting the following evening. The Bradley's gracious Georgian townhouse on Embassy Row is one of the city's salons. Reporters and politicians cross paths at off-the-record dinners there with Supreme Court justices, software billionaires, and heads of state. These families weren't accustomed to great wealth or influence, however. Indeed, most of them had never been to Washington before. Until recently, they had not known of one another, or of the unexpected benefactor who had brought them together. They were the parents of five Americans who had been kidnapped in Syria. The Federal Bureau of Investigation had warned the families not to talk publicly about their missing children, and the captors had threatened to kill their hostages if word leaked out. So each family had been going to work and to church month after month and reassuring colleagues and neighbors and relatives that nothing was wrong, only to come home and face new threats and ransom demands. After hiding the truth for so long, these families were heartened to learn that others were going through the same ordeal, and they hoped that by working together they might bring their children home. Bradley, 62 at the time, was pale and nearly bald, with a ring of vivid white hair. He has a priestly presence, meek, soft-spoken, hands clasped in his lap, but his courtly demeanor disguises considerable ambition and persistence. His publishing company, Atlantic Media, had amassed half a dozen titles, from National Journal to Quartz. Bradley was drawn into the family's tragedy because he had helped to free hostages once before. In 2011, soldiers loyal to the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi captured Claire Gillis, a freelancer who had contributed a few stories to The Atlantic's website in Libya, along with two other reporters. A fourth reporter was killed. Bradley had been surprised to learn that the U.S. government was not involved in negotiating the return of the hostages. Even though Gillis was not an Atlantic employee, Bradley had felt an obligation to help her. He assembled a small team, drawn mostly from his staff, to track her down. On a whiteboard, Bradley drew several concentric circles. The smallest represented people in charge of the hostages, such as guards and wardens. A wider circle included military officers and junior members of the Gaddafi administration. Wider still was the circle of senior Libyan officials, including Gaddafi and his family. The largest circle contained any people Bradley or his staffers could think of who might have a connection to those in the smaller rings. Bradley called this a network analysis chart. The idea was that someone would know someone who knew someone who could locate Gillis. The team pinpointed about 100 people to approach. One led to an American woman, Jacqueline Frazier, who had once lived in Tripoli, serving as the personal assistant to one of Gaddafi's sons. Frazier volunteered to return to Libya, and she persuaded her contacts in the government to release the reporters after 44 days of captivity. It hadn't been that hard to gain Gillis her freedom, but where would she be had no one tried? The success of that earlier venture in Libya emboldened Bradley to try his luck once more, this time in the even more chaotic killing fields of Syria. At the dinner in Washington, Bradley urged the families to serve themselves before the main course, chicken pot pie, got cold. When everyone was seated, he suggested going around the table with each family telling the others about their missing child. Jim. One of the reporters who had accompanied Gillis out of the Libyan prison in 2011 was a 37-year-old freelancer named James Foley. Bradley had never met Foley, but he received a thank you note after the release. A second note arrived a couple of weeks later, in which Foley said that he hadn't fully understood how much he owed to Bradley and his team. Bradley was touched that Foley had taken the extra trouble, and he presented the second letter to his children as a model of grace. A year later, Foley was kidnapped again in Syria on Thanksgiving Day, 2012. Foley's parents, John and Diane, live in a small town in New Hampshire. John practices internal medicine, and Diane worked as a nurse practitioner until she quit to focus on obtaining her son's freedom. Three of the five mothers at Bradley's gathering happened to be nurses. Diane had already experienced the journey through gray government offices that the others were about to endure. Her anger and weariness were evident, and some of the parents found her off-putting, but to others, her steeliness was inspiring. "She could run General Motors," one of the mothers said. Diane became the family's de facto leader. As Diane spoke about her son, she mentioned themes that the others recognized in their own children's stories, courage and idealism chief among them. Jim had been an altar boy in an observant Catholic family, the oldest of five children, growing up in Norman Rockwell country, as Diane described it. After graduating from Marquette University, Foley joined Teach for America and spent 3 years instructing eighth graders in history and social studies and coaching basketball in a rundown Latino neighborhood in Phoenix. He spent 2 years in Iraq, working for a USAID development project and embedding as a correspondent with the Indiana National Guard. In 2011, he went to Afghanistan as a reporter for the military paper Stars and Stripes. Foley was tall and striking, with his mother's long face and dark features, and his father's jutting Irish chin. Women were drawn to his wide, gap-toothed smile and welcoming eyes. He struck up conversations effortlessly, even in Syria, despite having rudimentary Arabic. He'd pass out cigarettes, trusting in the goodwill of strangers, while children trailed after him in the streets. After Foley was freed in the first kidnapping, his relatives joked about hiding his passport. Most of Foley's work had appeared in Global Post, an online news service founded by Philip Balboni. Balboni had offered Foley a desk job in Boston, but after a few months, he longed to be back in the field. He returned to Libya in October 2011 during the fall of the Gaddafi regime. In the following March, he was part of the first wave of Western reporters to enter Syria. The country quickly became a graveyard for correspondents, including Marie Colvin of the London Sunday Times and Anthony Shadid of the New York Times. But the war was heating up, and the migratory troop of war reporters set up camp on the Turkish border. Claire Gillis arrived, as did many of Foley's colleagues from previous wars. Those who knew Foley noticed that he had become more introspective. He showed a vulnerability that left him unable to manage the feelings stirred up by war. Like many of the reporters, he was fiercely opposed to violence, but helplessly drawn to conflict. One of his friends was a young photographer named Nicole Tung, whom he had known in Libya. The two of them spent a week in Aleppo in July 2012, working on a story about Dar al-Shifa Hospital. Jim had been very affected by what he had seen. People dying because of the lack of medical supplies, the heroism of doctors in the face of the savagery of the regime, which dropped barrel bombs on bread lines. Just as Jim and Nicole were coming out of an interview, a government jet roared overhead and bombed the apartments on the block. People began streaming out of the buildings, covered in dust and ash. Jim dutifully filmed the dead and injured, but the emotional distance that the lens often provided failed to block the emotions he felt. It was no longer enough for him to bear witness to the trauma that was unfolding in Syria. He had to do something. He set up an online fundraising campaign that brought in $10,000 for a used ambulance in Austria that he had shipped to the hospital in Aleppo. Jim and Nicole were there when it was delivered. A few months later, the government bombed the hospital. The ambulance was destroyed. When Diane didn't hear from Jim on Thanksgiving, she was worried. He always called on holidays. The next day, the phone did ring. It was Claire Gillis. Diane knew immediately that she wasn't calling to chat. "I felt shock," Diane recalled to me. "Anger," John added. "Why do we have to go through this again?" It wasn't immediately clear how alarmed Foley's friends and family should be. After all, he had survived the previous kidnapping. It had become an anecdote, confirmation of his bravado. But it was disquieting that there had been no word from his captors. Where was the ransom demand? The Foleys believed that the Syrian government was holding their son, and in January 2013, they publicly called for his release. Bradley wrote a note to Diane offering to help once again. Initially, she thought it unnecessary. Philip Balboni had hired Kroll, the investigations and security consulting firm, and the FBI was also on the case. So the Foleys felt that they were in good hands. By spring, however, their opinion had changed, including their assessment of officials at the Bureau. "They kept telling us to do nothing," Diane said. "And trust them," John added. "And telling us that our kid was their highest priority, which we didn't believe." In April 2013, Diane asked Bradley if he could put together another team. Bradley enlisted his general counsel and chief of staff, Arete Weiler, along with a few others in his office. He also contacted Wendy Kopp, the head of Teach for America, requesting volunteers. This new team, now numbering more than a dozen people, began creating another network analysis chart. The FBI and Kroll shared the Foley's view that Jim had been taken by the regime. It was logical. Shiite gangs affiliated with Bashar al-Assad, Syria's president, had kidnapped other reporters, reportedly including Austin Tice, a photojournalist from Houston. Sources claimed that the Syrian Air Force Intelligence Directorate was holding Westerners in a Damascus prison. That seemed better than the alternative. Syria was in tumult. More than 1,000 armed groups roamed the shattered country. Assad's regime was brutal, but at least it was a government with interests and alliances that could facilitate a deal. Moreover, U.S. law forbade paying ransoms to terrorists. Bradley's team sought out diplomats and journalists who had fixers in the region. They were looking for members of Assad's inner circle. Some Syrians living in exile had maintained ties to influential figures, and these elites would have been educated in American schools. Bradley's team also approached Russian supporters of Assad. But the sources consistently reported that the regime did not have Foley. Bradley recalled, "By summertime, I was of the view that if this was my child, I'd be looking in the north." That was ISIS territory now, a long way from Norman Rockwell country. Theo. Who is this man? Nancy Curtis had asked upon being told to get in touch with David Bradley. Why does he want to help us? She was skeptical by nature and not inclined to ask for favors. A museum administrator in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Curtis was the picture of a New England intellectual. Wry and doughty, her white hair chopped into an unruly page boy. But by the time she attended the dinner, her suspicions about Bradley had faded, and it was deeply comforting to be among people with the same secret. As Curtis learned about the other children, however, she was distressed to realize that the hostages themselves also carried secrets, ones that could get them killed. That was certainly true of her son. Peter Theophilus Padnos had a doctorate in comparative literature from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and he spoke French, German, and Russian. He had been working as a bicycle mechanic in 2004 when he abruptly decided to move to Yemen and study Arabic. It was a year into the Second Iraq War, and Americans were intensely unpopular in the region. Padnos had a little nest egg from the sale of his first book about teaching poetry to prisoners called My Life Had Stood a Loaded Gun. The title came from an Emily Dickinson poem. That was Theo, erudite, but interested in criminals and other outliers, always drawn to extremity. Yemen fascinated him. He'd never lived in a society where everybody believed in God. He studied at one of the world's most radical mosques, Dar al-Hadith, where al-Qaeda members had reportedly trained, and wrote a memoir about his experiences, Undercover Muslim, an unsparing account of the dead-end lives of the students and the propaganda of the imams. At the mosque, Padnos had declared allegiance to Islam in front of witnesses, and so his book seemed tantamount to apostasy, a mortal sin to radical Islamists. After the book came out, Padnos formally changed his name to Theo Curtis in order to continue traveling in Muslim countries, but he never bothered to change certain revealing personal details, such as his Facebook page. In the conspiratorial circles that Padnos often passed through, he had the profile of a spy, if not a very careful one. In October 2012, he traveled to Antakya, a Turkish border town that served as the informal headquarters of the press corps covering the Syrian conflict. The site of ancient Antioch had long been a tourist stop for Christian pilgrims. Now it was overrun with refugees, spies, and jihadis. To the east, across a mountain range, was Syria, where 100,000 people had already perished. About 50 journalists were covering Syria at the time. The battle for Aleppo was underway, and the war seemed to be nearing resolution. The wire services were still there, and occasionally the networks sent in a team, but most of the journalists were freelancers. They drank in the same bars and slept on one another's couches and sat in the same cafes in the morning, hiring fixers and making plans for their next trip across the border. They had little money and no security, but they were writing history. Islam was at war with itself. The map of the Middle East was being redrawn, and the freelancers had the story largely to themselves. Padnos was 44, a decade or two older than most of his colleagues. He spent a few days at a $10-a-night hotel, then rented an apartment with a Tunisian fishmonger. He soon met three young men who claimed to be providing supplies to the Free Syrian Army. At the time, reporters still regularly crossed into Syria. Foley wasn't kidnapped until a month later. The three men and Padnos went to the border and squeezed through a hole in a barbed wire fence. Padnos hadn't told anyone where he was going. Few people even knew that he had been in Antakya. Nancy Curtis was puzzled when her son stopped writing. He was helping her buy a wood stove for a vacation house that she owned in Vermont, and they had been communicating daily. After 3 days, she finally got an email. The subject line said, "Hey." There was no message. Curtis called her cousin, Viva Hardig. "Something calamitous has happened," Curtis said. Hardig immediately believed her. She enlisted two other cousins, Amy Rosen, who was the chairman of the board of the Kipp Charter Schools in Newark, and Betsy Sullivan, an editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Rosen had served on Amtrak's board of directors and knew her way around Washington. Sullivan brought the experience of having been detained by the Bosnian Serb army while reporting on that conflict. Curtis, Hardig, Sullivan, and Rosen became known as the all-girl team. Curtis contacted the International Committee of the Red Cross, which often visits prisons to assess human rights violations. She was hoping to learn that the Syrian government was holding her son. The woman she talked to had no information about that, but shared some news. "I shouldn't be telling you this," she said, "but there's another family in New England you ought to call." She gave her Diane Foley's number. At the time, U.S. government policy was to keep information about hostages strictly secret for privacy reasons. But Diane and Nancy were each immensely relieved to learn of another family searching for a son in Syria. They traded information about avenues they had explored and people they had approached, workers for non-governmental organizations, NGOs, State Department officials, FBI agents, and they rebuked themselves for failing to set up emergency contacts for their sons and for not getting their digital passwords. As each learned more about the other's son, she saw how much the men had in common. "What good friends they'll be when this is all over," they often said. One night in May 2013, Amy Rosen was invited to a dinner that was part of the Atlantic's Ideas Forum in New York. She intended just to drop by for a drink, but she stuck around when she realized that she was seated next to David Bradley. Rosen had met him socially before. She confided in him about Padnos and the failure of the all-girl team to find him. Bradley described his theory of concentric circles, but admitted that his team still hadn't located Foley. They decided to combine efforts. The first break in the kidnappings occurred on July 29th, 2013, when an American photojournalist, Matt Schreier, escaped from his cell in Syria after 7 months of captivity and crossed into Turkey. He told C.J. Chivers of The Times that in January he had been placed in a cell with another American who was filthy and had a ragged beard. The American said that his captors had accused him of working for the CIA. For months, the men were tortured, sometimes by a 12-year-old who beat them and shocked them with tasers. They were forced to make videotaped confessions, wearing orange jumpsuits that mimicked the prisoner uniforms worn at the U.S. internment camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Schreier recalled that he and his cellmate had gouged a hole in the wire mesh on one window. Schreier said that he was able to squeeze through, but said his cellmate was larger and couldn't break free. Although the Times didn't name the other American, Nancy received a call from officials at the State Department 2 days after Schreier's escape. "We have proof of life on Theo," they said. Stephen. Shirley Sotloff felt that she was in a movie, watching people act out roles, Even the Bradleys' beautiful home with servers carrying silver trays resembled a set. It certainly didn't seem real when David Bradley said that Secretary of State John Kerry had been at this same table the previous week, and the King of Jordan before that. Her husband Art observed the furnishings in the Bradleys' house with an appreciative professional eye. His business was organizing home shows, exhibitions offering furnishing ideas. He noticed the hand-carved dining set, the chandelier with actual candles, the pale yellow fabric covering the dining room walls. The Sotloffs, who were from Pinecrest, Florida, a Miami suburb, brought with them Barack Barfi, a researcher for the New America Foundation. He was the best friend of their son, Stephen, a journalist who had been held in Syria for 9 months. Barfi, brilliant and assertive, was controversial among the families. He clearly felt that he should lead the group, since he spoke fluent Arabic and was by far the most knowledgeable among them about the Middle East. On August 4, 2013, it was Barfi who notified Art that Stephen was missing. Art didn't tell Shirley. He didn't want to worry her in case Stephen suddenly showed up. But after 4 days, Shirley suspected something. Art poured himself a scotch and gave her the news. Stephen had lived in the Middle East for many years, but hadn't done much to disguise that he was Jewish. It could be discovered by a Google search or a look at his Facebook page. He had a defiant nonchalance that had posed problems for him in the past. He was such a difficult student that Shirley and Art had sent him to a treatment center for troubled boys and then to the Kimball Union Academy, an elite boarding school in New Hampshire. Sarcastic and argumentative, but with a ready and infectious laugh, Steve had the reputation of being an underachiever. Then, in his junior year, he resurrected the school paper, the Kimball Union, which had gone defunct because of lack of funding. Stephen and another student raised the money to resuscitate and completely revamp it, winning a collegiate journalism award for their effort. He had found his calling. In 2005, Stephen entered the Interdisciplinary Center Herzliya, an Israeli college, where he played rugby and joined the debate society. He also took Israeli citizenship. He wanted to become a reporter, and wrote to Barfi, then a producer for ABC News affiliates, asking for advice about studying Arabic abroad. Barfi, who was 10 years older than Stephen, became his mentor. "He was a young, chubby kid," Barfi recalled. "I told him, you can go to Egypt, which has a good teaching infrastructure, but you'll be overexposed to Western influences. You could go to Syria, where you won't be so exposed to the West, but will be pursued by security people all the time. The best place is Yemen. There are no Westerners. The state is weak, and you'll be pretty much left alone." Stephen took his counsel. In Sana'a, he posed as a Chechen American from a secular Muslim family. "I converted in my first week, so I wouldn't have to deal with all that rubbish," he wrote to a friend. LOL. The Arab Spring began in 2010, and aspiring journalists like Sotloff swarmed into the region. Soon he was freelancing for the Christian Science Monitor, Foreign Policy, and Time. He was in Tahrir Square the day President Hosni Mubarak stepped down in 2011, and in Libya the following year, where he first met Jim Foley. For Time, he provided crucial coverage of the attack on the U.S. compound in Benghazi, where 4 Americans were killed, including the ambassador. He wrote about the flow of arms from Libya to Syria, and in December of that year, he reported from Aleppo. During that period, when American foreign policy depended on information arising from these zones of conflict, Sotloff never made enough money to have to file a tax return. Many publications began pulling back their staff from areas of conflict, which only increased their reliance on freelancers, who had none of the institutional support that the great news organizations bring with them. "It's the freelancer's conundrum," Jim Foley told Newsweek in 2012. "I think it's just the basic laws of competition. You need to have something the staffers don't. But in a conflict zone, that means you take bigger risks. Go in sooner, stay longer, get closer." After Claire Gillis was captured in Libya, Bradley and his editorial board decided they could not accept or commission freelance work in war zones unless the journalist had previous experience, a thorough security plan, insurance, and appropriate equipment. Of course, there were scarcely any freelancers who could supply such assurances. "I've been here over a week, and no one wants freelance because of the kidnappings," Stephen complained to a friend in October 2012 while he was in northern Syria. "I've been sleeping at a front, hiding from tanks the past few nights, drinking rainwater." The journalists in Antakya maintained a secret Facebook site that functioned as a message board for reporters and aid workers planning to enter Syria. The news was that Turkish airports and train stations were filling up with foreign fighters who were flocking to the conflict. "Beardos," Jim Foley called them. No one knew what to make of this new element. Some members of the site began speculating that spotters on the border were selling information about reporters to Islamists. In December 2012, criminals associated with the Free Syrian Army abducted Richard Engel, an NBC correspondent, and five members of his crew. Two aid workers, an Italian and a British man, were taken in March 2013, a Danish photographer in May, four French journalists and a German tourist in June. About 70 Syrian reporters had been killed in 2012 and 2013. Because the media observed a blackout on abductions, more reporters kept arriving, not fully aware of the dangers they faced. Many journalists who were in Antakya at the time now speak of having maintained a willful ignorance, even as the risks became obvious. They talked among themselves about the dangers, but kept crossing the border, sustained by the adventure, the significance of the story, and the exhilaration of survival. "It's easy to feel invincible, even with death all around," Sotloff wrote to Janine DiGiovanni, the Middle East editor for Newsweek. "It's like, this is my movie, sucker. I'm not gonna die." Peter. David Bradley burst out laughing when Paula and Ed Kassig showed up for dinner that night. Earlier, when Bradley issued the invitation, Ed had nervously asked if there was a dress code. "Black tie, of course," Bradley had said. Ed arrived in a short-sleeved tattersall shirt with a black tie that he'd cadged from the concierge at the hotel. It became a running joke between them. At the dinner, Ed and Paula tried to sort out who was who. Some of the other families had brought along an advisor. Barfi, who came with the Sotloffs, had been folded into Bradley's team, as had Jim Foley's former girlfriend, April Goebel, who runs the Kipp Schools in Chicago. Several members of Bradley's staff were also present. "But you knew the other parents right away," Ed observed. Paula and Ed lived in Indianapolis. She was a public health nurse. He taught high school biology. He was in the classroom on October 1st, 2013, when his phone began vibrating. His flip phone was so old that his pitying students could scarcely recognize it. Sometimes, when he left it sitting on his desk, he returned to find coins beside it. Ed's phone indicated that he'd received an international call. He assumed that it was his son, Peter, who was doing humanitarian work in Turkey and sometimes crossing into Syria. Ed thought that if it was important, Peter would call back. The school day ended, and Ed went outside, where buses were loading, and there was the usual commotion of the kids leaving. His phone rang again. Ed answered, thinking it was Peter. But it was someone else, a friend of Peter's, who was trying to explain something. But Ed couldn't hear clearly because of the racket. It was homecoming weekend, and as Ed moved to a quieter spot, a marching band burst through the doors. Ed couldn't break away. The drum line seemed to be deliberately trailing him. The one word that registered through the din was detained. Unlike the other families, Ed and Paula received a message from ISIS right away. "It was almost cordial," Paula recalled. "We have your son. We are treating him as a guest." A second, more ominous note followed. "You say he is an aid worker? We know that all Westerners who say the REMTs are aid workers are just spies and just sent over as part of the war between the West and the East." The captors asked for $100 million, but didn't specify dollars or euros. They also demanded the release of all Muslim prisoners worldwide. "Like that was something we were going to be able to do," Paula said. ISIS warned that Peter would be killed if word of the kidnapping leaked out, so the Kassigs bore the additional weight of fearing that their friends might guess what was going on. People were always asking about Peter's welfare. "I hope he's not in Syria," people said probingly, and Ed would respond, "Don't worry, he's not." He was playing with words. Technically, he figured, Peter was in the Islamic State. Like Theopadnos and Stephen Sotloff, Peter Kassig also had something to hide. He had served in Iraq in the Army Rangers. He left with an honorable medical discharge after only 4 months at war, and friends weren't sure what had happened. He returned to Indianapolis and trained to be an emergency medical technician, then studied political science at Butler University. But he was restless and looking for direction. He got married, but the union quickly dissolved. Kassig was a driven soul, his parents acknowledge, and highly unpredictable. During his senior year, he told Ed and Paula that he was spending spring break camping in the Smoky Mountains. A week later, he called them from Beirut, where he was working in a refugee camp, watching people die in front of him. In a few hours, he said, his return flight was scheduled to leave, but he couldn't abandon them. He finally knew what he was going to do with the rest of his life. A CNN reporter later filmed him in a hospital bandaging wounded Syrian refugees. He still wore his hair in a military-style buzz cut, and his arms were covered with tattoos. "This is what I was put here to do," he told the reporter. "I guess I'm just a hopeless romantic. And I'm an idealist. And I believe in hopeless causes." In 2012, Kassig established his own NGO called Special Emergency Response and Assistance. His goal was to provide food and blankets and medical supplies where they were most needed. He enlisted Ed and Paula to raise money at their Methodist church. In Turkey, he taught emergency care to reporters and photographers on the border. One of his friends coined a verb, to kassig, which meant to selflessly put oneself in harm's way in order to help others in need, all the while looking suave and sexy. Kassig had been friends with Stephen Sotloff and joined the effort to find him. "We have to be ruthlessly efficient and professional in securing information and his eventual safe release," he wrote to a friend. "Someone we know knows where Stephen is and who has him. This can go one of two ways. Either we do right and get our beloved friend back, or this goes south and he gets hurt, or worse. But 2 months passed without any significant leads. Shortly before Kasich was abducted, he admitted in a call to his parents that he was a little more worried about this trip. He had promised to deliver medical supplies to Deir ez-Zor, the largest city in eastern Syria, where his medical expertise was desperately needed. The city once had about 500 doctors. Now there were only 5. Factions and allegiances were shifting, Peter told his parents. Ed and Paula didn't know exactly what he meant, but it sounded ominous. Soon after Kasich entered Syria, he called a co-worker. He said that he'd been stopped at a roadblock and told to report to an ISIS commander. If you don't hear from me in several hours, Kasich said, institute the emergency protocol. That was when Ed got the call. Later, a European hostage, who had been held with Stephen Sotloff, told Ed and Paula about the day Peter was put in their cell. Steve, Peter cried, I finally found you.
Kayla.
Carl Mueller was working in his body shop in Prescott, Arizona, when he got a call from a man he'd never met. Barak Barfi, who said that he knew about the abduction of his daughter, Kayla. Carl froze. He and his wife, Marcia, had stopped seeing friends because people were always asking about Kayla, and they didn't want to lie. Kayla was well-known and admired in Prescott. In high school, she received a Presidential Medal for public service, and she won a $500 prize for her local philanthropic efforts. She gave the money to charity. At Northern Arizona University, she founded a branch of Amnesty International and a service organization for veterans, while also working for peace groups and teaching anger management in the county jail. Despite all this activity, she graduated in 2 years, impatient to get out into the world. In India, she worked with orphans. In Tibet, she taught English to refugees. Kayla had grown up a Baptist, but she was fascinated by different religions. She was devoted to the teachings of the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, and for a time considered becoming a nun in his Buddhist community in France. But Kayla was an activist by nature. In Israel, she worked with African refugees, and in Palestine, she stood outside houses scheduled to be bulldozed by the Israeli military. Let me live on both sides of the wall before I act, she wrote in her diary. In the fall of 2010, she came home, suffering from typhoid and parasites, and recuperated for a year while volunteering at an AIDS clinic, which she took over, and working at a women's shelter at night. She hoped to join the Peace Corps. She had been told that if she became fluent in French, she would be sent to Africa, so she took a job as an au pair in France. Before she left, she cut off her ponytail to donate to Locks of Love, which provides hair pieces for children with cancer. She made Marcia promise to send it. Given the scale of suffering in Syria, it wasn't surprising that Kayla would be drawn there. She was abducted the same day as Sotloff, just before her 25th birthday. Kayla had been missing for a few months when Barfi called Carl to say that a wealthy man in Washington, D.C. wanted to help the Muellers and others in the same situation. Carl and Marcia had been dreading that the news of Kayla's abduction would get out and the kidnappers would follow through on their threat. Now somebody knew. What kind of name was Barak Barfi? Was he one of the terrorists? Carl went behind his shop, knelt down, and prayed. Of all the families, the Muellers were the most isolated. Even at the Bradleys' home, Carl and Marcia were anxious. The FBI had assured them that Kayla would probably be safe because she was a woman. Was it wise to get her case mixed up with others? Although Marcia quickly felt a sense of solidarity with the other mothers, Carl remained mistrustful. To him, Bradley seemed like something out of a comic book fantasy, a person with vast resources who could summon powerful people at will. And given that Bradley was the publisher of The Atlantic, Carl wondered, was this just an elaborate way of getting a story? Less than a month before the dinner, four French journalists had been released by ISIS, apparently ransomed by the French government, along with five members of Doctors Without Borders. One of the journalists told Carl that Kayla had been held in another cell at the prison, and that he'd often heard her speaking French to one of the Doctors Without Borders prisoners. But in recent months, Kayla had been in solitary. Sometimes the men were able to leave notes for her in the toilet. The day the French journalists were freed, the guards brought Kayla to them so they could confirm that she was alive. She gave the journalists a letter to take to her parents, which Marcia read aloud at the Bradleys' dinner table. "Everyone, if you are receiving this letter, it means I am still detained," the letter begins. It was written in tiny script on paper ripped out of a spiral notebook and full of abbreviations. "Please know that I am in a safe location, completely unharmed and healthy. Put on weight, in fact. I have been treated with the utmost respect and kindness." She had wanted to write a well-thought-out letter, but had been given the opportunity only at the last minute. "Just the thought of you all sends me into a fit of tears," she wrote. "If you could say I have suffered at all throughout this whole experience, it is only in knowing how much suffering I have put you all through. I will never ask you to forgive me, as I do not deserve forgiveness." Kayla listed some things she thought of with special fondness. Her little niece, her first camping trip. She fantasized about how much she'd love the reunion at the airport when they finally met again. The letter ended forcefully. "I do not want the negotiations for my release to be your duty. If there is any other option, take it. All my everything. Kayla." The other parents were moved by Kayla's letter and by the picture Carl painted of their daughter, who seemed like a cross between a barefooted sprite and a Buddhist saint. He called her Special K. Of course, all the hostages were remarkable people, and their finest qualities had led them to Syria. "If anything bound us together, it was our children and their courage and compassion," John Foley recalled. Earlier, Philip Balboni, the Global Post founder, had asked how many parents wanted the U.S. military to attempt a rescue. Not a single hand went up. It seemed too dangerous. Now Bradley suggested that the families consider publicizing the kidnappings. The Foleys agreed with Bradley that going to the media might put pressure on the U.S. government and possibly the hostage takers. The Sotloffs were willing to consider this, but the Kasigs were so opposed that the idea was tabled. How could you know if ISIS was bluffing with its threat to kill the hostages? The families tried to select one member of the team to deal with ransom demands collectively. But who could be trusted with the lives of their children? Barfi desperately wanted this responsibility. But some parents were wary. He was aggressive, and perhaps he was too heartbroken by Sotloff's abduction to think clearly. The Kasigs had brought along an advisor, Peter's partner in his NGO, and they nominated him instead. A power struggle among the family advocates followed, which resulted in no one being chosen for the role. Barfi was bitter. "Either I should have been more restrained, or I should have gotten on top of the table and said, 'Your kids are in dire danger. he recalled. They decided to go with unanimity. I said, that's like the Arab League. You'll never get anything done. You need a leader. The families signed a statement authorizing Bradley to receive updates about the hostages from the FBI and other government agencies. The families left the dinner feeling hopeful and relieved. Bradley was a powerful champion, and now they had one another. Art Sotloff impulsively hugged Bradley, who recoiled slightly. He has a formal manner, and the families quickly concluded that he doesn't like to be touched. Before everyone left, Bradley expressed the hope that they would soon meet again, with their children, in the same lovely room. The next afternoon, the families met in the West Wing of the White House with Lisa Monaco, the Homeland Security Advisor to President Barack Obama, and members of the National Security Council. The families had written a letter to Obama, calling themselves parents of American hostages in Syria. They asked Obama to give them a clear idea of what could be done. ISIS seemed to be proceeding in an orderly manner in releasing European hostages, first the Spanish and then the French. An Italian journalist was freed several days after the White House meeting. The released Europeans spoke of enduring torture and starvation. They heard frequent gunfire, presumably the sound of Syrian and Iraqi prisoners being executed. Some of the Westerners were more abused than others, but the treatment was always capricious and sadistic. These accounts dismayed the families, yet they were also fortified by the intelligence they had gained from the Europeans about their children's lives in captivity. This is a moment of opportunity, the group letter to the president said. We have knowledge of the groups that are holding our children. We have knowledge of their location and the motives of their captors. We have examples of successful releases facilitated by foreign governments. At the meeting, the families asked that Obama appoint someone to coordinate among the White House, the FBI, and the State Department, providing the timely information they needed to make life and death decisions. Officials at the White House meeting expressed sympathy and concern, but were vague about what the government might do to help. On this and two other occasions, Colonel Mark Mitchell, the director of counterterrorism at the National Security Council, bluntly warned the families that they risked prosecution if they paid terrorists or tried to persuade an allied power to do so. I'd rather be in prison myself and have Jimmy home, John Foley said afterward. Nancy Curtis shrugged it off. I'm 76 years old. Let them put me in jail. The fact that the European hostages were safely home underscored the ineffectiveness of American policy. Didier Francois, a released hostage, told me that although French officials publicly deny paying ransoms, they do negotiate because every French citizen taken is an attack on French sovereignty. Francois added, It doesn't mean we surrender to all the demands of the captors. It doesn't mean we change our foreign policy. The German magazine Focus reported that the French government paid ransoms totaling 18 million euros for the four journalists. Francois called this sum ridiculous. He explained that captors always start high, but skillful diplomacy can moderate their demands. He added, As long as it doesn't change the situation on the ground, why should we not get our people out? The U.S. government's position was that the Europeans imperil everybody by paying off terrorists. In a 2012 speech, David Cohen, then the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence at the Treasury Department, said, Ransom payments lead to future kidnappings, and future kidnappings lead to additional ransom payments. It all builds the capacity of terrorist organizations to conduct attacks. The U.S. government estimated that between 2008 and 2014, radical Islamist groups collected more than $200 million in ransom payments, which allowed those groups to spread. ISIS might not exist in its present rampant form without the funds that kidnapping provided. The families themselves had mixed feelings about ransoms. The Foleys were already seeking pledges and eventually obtained nearly $1 million worth. The Kessigs stayed up late worrying over the morality of giving money to a terrorist group, yet their only child's life was at stake, and ISIS was already rich. If we had been able to come up with any ransom, it would have been much smaller than what they were getting daily from the oil fields, Paula observed. Carl Mueller felt that the government was putting its precious policy ahead of their daughter's life. Marcia, however, didn't want ISIS to receive another cent, and didn't think that Kayla would either. Although the Sotloffs were considering a ransom, Barfi privately thought the practice misguided. "You're funding terrorism," Barfi said. "What happens if ISIS uses the money to fund an attack?" This was the stated logic behind U.S. policy. And yet the government has paid ransoms to criminal organizations such as drug cartels. Every Federal Reserve branch in the United States maintains a stash of bills to be used to pay ransoms. Corporations routinely take out ransom insurance for employees stationed abroad, and the FBI even facilitates such payments. It's only when the kidnappers are part of an acknowledged terrorist group that payments become illegal. Hovering silently over this wrenching discussion was the fact of Bradley's fortune. He was already bankrolling the team that was trying to free the hostages. He was absorbing the family's travel expenses. He was flying to foreign destinations himself. His generosity was without question, but not, apparently, without limits. Prudent and conservative by temperament, he had forbidden his staff to discuss ransoms. Carl Mueller hinted that he was willing to sell his house, but Bradley didn't bite. The risk of prosecution that made Bradley wary of ransoms posed an obstacle to other potential donors as well, and there was an additional complication. If Bradley was known to be involved, the ransom demands would inevitably increase. Art Sotloff was incensed by the repeated threats of prosecution. He and Shirley had received the same outlandish ransom demand as the Foleys and the Kessigs, 100 million euros. The U.S. government could refuse to help them, but why should it stand in their way if they turned to other sources? At one government meeting, Art excused himself to go to the men's room, and an FBI agent escorted him down the hall. The agent confided that no American had ever been prosecuted for paying a ransom. The families were confounded by the mixed messages. Moreover, if the government actually did prosecute them, wouldn't these very agents have to testify against them? In any case, because of international sanctions, it was exceedingly difficult to send any money to Syria, much less millions of dollars. In September 2013, Nancy Curtis had tried to wire $8,000 to a fixer in Aleppo, who had heard a rumor that an American hostage had been condemned to death by a Sharia court. The source was willing to investigate further, but wanted payment. Curtis tried to use Western Union to send the money to an intermediary in Beirut, but when she had to describe the purpose of the transfer, she was refused. The all-girl team then divided the sum among themselves. Viva Hardig, Curtis's cousin, took her children to the bank. And while the kids begged for lollipops, the teller put the wire transfer through. The Aleppo fixer reported hearing that the American hostage had been killed. The all-girl team decided not to tell Nancy Curtis. Then several months later, she received a Skype call from someone who claimed to be in touch with Padnos's kidnappers. The intermediary asked for proof-of-life questions that only Padnos could answer. Curtis and the all-girl team came up with such questions as, "Where is your car?" "In the barn." The correct answers came back the following day. Padnos was alive. Apparently, the intermediary was also able to relay messages from Padnos. One of them was, "Sorry, Mom. I should have listened to you." Curtis had previously dealt with intermediaries, and their demands had ranged between 3 million and 5 million euros. Those conversations never went anywhere. Were the intermediaries really in contact with her son? All the families had to contend with scammers who claimed to represent the hostage takers. The Kassigs were approached by somebody they called Bitcoin Man, who described in detail how to transmit money through the internet. Curtis had already calculated that she could raise $200,000 in cash, and perhaps twice that if she sold her vacation house in Vermont. But if she had to sell her house in Cambridge, too, how would she live? Would there be anything left for her daughter and her family? Was it right to throw everything she had into a murky deal with terrorists? This intermediary demanded 15 million euros to release Padnos, triple what had been originally proposed, but a fraction of what was being asked for Foley, Sotloff, and Kassig. The price for Kayla Mueller was 5 million euros. On the advice of the FBI, Curtis countered with $50,000. The idea was to get the captors to think realistically about what the family could pay. On May 31, 2014, while this negotiation was underway, the U.S. suddenly exchanged 5 Taliban leaders held in Guantanamo for a sergeant in the U.S. Army, Bo Bergdahl. President Obama justified the swap by noting that military prisoners are routinely traded at the end of a conflict. Evidently, he believed that American involvement in Afghanistan had reached such a point. Some of the families felt deceived. They'd just been told that ransoms and prisoner exchanges were out of bounds. They were also alarmed by the public furor that followed the Bergdahl swap. It seemed certain to make the captors more intransigent, and the U.S. government even less willing to act on the family's behalf. Fortunately, the parents still had Bradley's team on their side, but none of them realized how little time they had left. David Bradley grew up as a Christian Scientist, believing that God created man as a perfect being. Disease, death, pain, and evil were imaginary afflictions that could be prayed away. Although Bradley no longer saw himself as especially religious, many tenets of the faith had left their mark on him. "I remain deeply sympathetic to Christian Science, but as to evil, I've changed my mind," he said. "There is evil in the world." Catherine Bradley observed that her husband had a fundamental quality of faithfulness, which is not the same thing as faith. Most of the Bradley's charities concentrated on education and poverty in the U.S. Her husband didn't seek out additional projects, she said, but when a need arose, he had a hard time turning away. She shared a story from the Philippines, where Bradley went on a Fulbright scholarship in 1977. Ferdinand Marcos then ruled the country. Bradley, who had just received an MBA from Harvard, was there, studying whether multinational corporations prefer to operate under authoritarian governments. They do. He subsequently set up a child protection unit at a Manila hospital. Every year he returns to the city to visit the matriarch he stayed with as a student, who was 103 on his most recent trip. "The Philippines just came into his life," Catherine said. "He attached and never let go. Growing up in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., Bradley developed a longing for power. At 13, he imagined becoming the Republican junior senator from Maryland by the age of 30. When he was 20, he worked as an intern in the Nixon White House, just as the Watergate scandal was unfolding. He then enrolled at Georgetown Law School. Deciding that he needed an income to support a political career, he took a year off to start a policy research firm, the Advisory Board Company, then spun off a division of it, the Corporate Executive Board. Most of his business was in healthcare consulting. His office was in the living room of his mother's apartment in the Watergate. 20 years later, he took one of the businesses public. 2 years after that, he sold the second. These deals made him about $300 million richer. He now owns one of the buildings in the Watergate complex. By the time Bradley made his fortune, he had reluctantly abandoned his political dreams. Although he desired power, he cherished humility. He was not someone who could turn heads while entering a room. He speaks in a near whisper, the result of nerve damage to his vocal cords. His elaborately deferential manner can make him seem aloof or strange, even enigmatic. Such qualities are ill-suited for a political life, and his shortcomings became especially apparent when he compared himself to his next-door neighbor on Embassy Row, an attractive young senator who seemed to be the embodiment of the man Bradley had sought to be. But eventually, the life of that senator, John Edwards, took a wrong turn, and the house next door now served as the Hungarian embassy. Bradley's search for influence found other outlets in wealth, media, and philanthropy. In directing the family's efforts, Bradley was in some respects usurping the role of several federal agencies, and yet the families had largely lost faith in their government. The State Department appointed Carrie Green in the Office of Overseas Citizens Services to be a liaison with the families. She seemed impatient with their independent investigations. "You really shouldn't be talking to these terrorists," she warned. "It's against the law." Viva Hardig responded, "Excuse me, Carrie, but we are well acquainted with U.S. laws, and if someone you love is being held by terrorists, with whom else should you talk?" Green ended her emails with, "Please enjoy your day." When Peter Kessig was kidnapped, his parents got a call from a State Department official. Paula recalled, "She basically said, 'We know your son has been taken in Syria. We don't have an embassy in Syria. We don't have people on the ground in Syria. We don't have a diplomatic relationship with them, so we can't do anything to help you.'" In May 2014, the families had a joint meeting with Daniel Rubenstein, a special envoy appointed to handle affairs in Syria. He was nice, but when we asked how to contact him, we were told not to email or phone him. Diane Foley said, "In order to talk with him on the phone, the families had to travel to a local FBI office so an agent could dial Rubenstein's number for them. When the Foleys drove to the Boston office for this purpose, they learned that the phone line they were using wasn't even secure. So what was the point? They concluded that the only reason for the protocol was to allow local agents to monitor them. At least 3 FBI agents were assigned to each family, one supervising agent, one for victim assistance, and one for hostage negotiation. Nancy Curtis describes one of her agents as professional, compassionate, and committed. But none of the other families believed that the Bureau was aggressive enough. The FBI called me once a week from Washington, every Tuesday between 3:30 and 4 o'clock, without fail, just to see if I had information for them," Art Sotloff said. "Not to give me information. After 3 or 4 phone calls, I just let them go to voicemail." The FBI is authorized to investigate the kidnapping of American citizens. The Bureau has long experience with the crime domestically, but is poorly equipped to handle foreign cases in which the motivation for the abduction is political. Bradley's team scheduled a meeting for Nancy Curtis and the chief FBI hostage negotiator. The agent insisted that the Bureau had jurisdiction over kidnappings, but then the State Department, which has no expertise in criminal investigations, informed Curtis that it was in charge. Bradley's team then set up a meeting with Robert Ford, the last U.S. ambassador to Syria. Ford said that although the FBI does have jurisdiction, the State Department has an understanding of Syrian culture in the region that the Bureau lacks. Curtis left these meetings frustrated and confused. Not only was there a turf war, it was obvious that the agencies weren't sharing information. State essentially backed down, leaving the fate of the hostages in the hands of the FBI. To the FBI, it's natural that it should lead the kidnapping cases wherever they occur. The Bureau, a senior FBI official explained, pursues three related goals in a kidnapping investigation: the safe return of the hostage, collection of intelligence about the captor network, and the eventual prosecution of the perpetrators. Although FBI agents felt that Bradley and his team were acting nobly, they considered them amateurs entering a sensitive and dangerous environment with American lives in the balance. The Bureau does not like its playing field to be crowded with competitors. Bradley's team gave the FBI any leads it turned up, but the Bureau made it clear that this was not a partnership. "We're happy to take their information," the FBI official told me, but noted that the relationship could not be fully reciprocal. Bradley, his team members, and the families lacked the security clearances that would allow them to look at all the data that the FBI was collecting. The official admitted, however, that in some of these cases, the lack of information passed to the families was simply because there was a lack of information. At certain key points, the FBI forcefully shut down an investigative path that members of the Bradley team were following, usually with the explanation that they had to de-conflict their effort with one that presumably the Bureau was conducting on its own. "Swords get crossed," the FBI official noted, but people close to the scene saw little evidence that the Bureau was investigating with urgency. After Jim Foley's abduction in November 2012, it took 2 weeks for the FBI to dispatch a pair of agents to Antakya to interview his friends. To be fair, the Bureau requires permission from the Turkish government to conduct investigations. As in most other foreign countries where the Bureau works, it is forbidden to go undercover there, and it has to get clearance from the CIA before cultivating sources. In Antakya, the FBI agents who showed up seemed woefully out of place and inexperienced. "Fish out of water," as Nicole Tung put it. Tung and Claire Gillis, the freelancer who had been abducted with Foley in Libya, worried that Foley was a low priority for the United States. The journalists on the ground believed that the Bureau never interviewed any of the fixers who had been captured with the hostages and then released. The journalists knew these fixers well. In any case, that was the last that the journalists saw of the FBI. The Bradley team eventually contacted more than 150 people. Only a handful of them said that they had spoken to the U.S. government. According to a former federal official, there was a mistaken interpretation of U.S. policy against ransoms. It was taken to mean no negotiating at all, and that even talking to the hostage takers was forbidden. Neither the White House nor the National Security Council stepped in to clarify the matter, leaving the investigation essentially paralyzed. The CIA, which collects intelligence abroad, apparently gathered little of use about the hostages. Robert Ford told Bradley's team that the agency had no assets closer to Syria than Gaziantep, Turkey, 30 miles from the border. Although Bradley's team and some of the reporters in Antakya identified sites where the hostages were likely being held, there was no drone surveillance until late in the crisis, and even then, only one drone was made available for part of the day. The president wouldn't authorize it, Barfi said. He didn't want to get into Syria. While Bradley lacked the government's resources, he had impressive connections, and he didn't feel constrained by protocol. Several of the families worried that information on the hostages' social media sites could be used against them. Sotloff's Israeli citizenship, Padnos's book on Islam, Kassig's army experience in Iraq. But the FBI said that it could not gain access to the hostages' accounts because of privacy concerns. Bradley called Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of Facebook, Dick Costolo, then the CEO of Twitter, and Brad Smith, the general counsel of Microsoft, and they were immediately willing to work with the families to help. Bradley prides himself on his ability to discover and enlist what he calls extreme talent. Soon after he acquired The Atlantic, he successfully lured away Jeffrey Goldberg, a writer then working for The New Yorker. Bradley's blandishments included going to Goldberg's house with a trailer full of ponies for his children to ride. In an era when many magazines were retrenching or folding, it was extraordinary for a publisher to court a journalist so lavishly. And the story spread through the trade. Barak Barfi heard about the Goldberg pony gambit in Turkey. "Why are you doing this?" Goldberg asked Bradley when he heard about the team he had assembled. After all, Bradley was not the Attorney General or the Secretary of Defense. Bradley responded, "When I wake in the morning, I could study online advertising patterns, or I could try in some way to save the lives of Americans who are held by fanatics. When I looked at the options in front of me, it was obvious what was the best use of my time." Goldberg believed that Bradley's obsession with hostages began with the death of Michael Kelly, the first journalist Bradley hired to edit The Atlantic. As Goldberg puts it, Kelly was hysterically rude and bitingly funny, qualities that Bradley admired, but certainly didn't share. Kelly and Bradley became close. Kelly was the first reporter to be killed in the Iraq War in April 2003. After burying Kelly, Bradley realized, "I had trouble letting one of my colleagues do something I couldn't do." The next year, he traveled to Baghdad, where William Langevisha was reporting for The Atlantic. At the time, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, the precursor of ISIS, was beheading Westerners and posting videos on the internet. Bradley was genuinely frightened. At the hotel where he was staying, he was told to shove the dresser and an extra bed against the door. Despite such precautions, a journalist was kidnapped from that hotel a few weeks later. Bradley kept adding people to the team, paying their travel expenses and often a salary as well. He installed two young researchers in cubicles in the Watergate office. He recruited a former Syrian diplomat, now known as Nur Azar, who had gone into exile after the revolution. Meanwhile, April Goebel, Foley's ex-girlfriend, worked with 11 volunteers from Teach for America, looking for inroads into the Syrian regime. Bradley also discovered a West Coast lawyer who had moved to Kandahar, Afghanistan, to study insurgencies. She traveled around on a motorcycle with an assault rifle around her shoulders, Bradley said. Her job was interviewing potential Taliban recruits and giving reports to NGOs. Because the lawyer still works in the region, she asked me to refer to her as Mary Hardy. Bradley's dazzled staff called her the Blonde Bombshell. Bradley sent Hardy to Antakya in June 2013. Foley and Padnos were the only ones taken at the time. Antakya struck her as a typical bad border town. The place was filled with intelligence agents, Turkish and otherwise. Jihadists and smugglers and young freelancers had taken over the tourist hotels. Because only Foley's name had been made public, Hardy recalls, she was besieged by people offering to sell her information about him. The town was awash in Foley's alive, Foley's dead, Foley's in Damascus, Foley's coming out tomorrow. Just get in my van and I can take you to see him. Hardy sought out more experienced journalists and aid workers in the area. They had fixers who spoke Arabic and could get the phone numbers of ISIS commanders and the GPS coordinates of their various headquarters. Hardy learned that the people who had abducted Padnos and Matt Schreier were using Schreier's PayPal account to order such items as sunglasses. The items were delivered to a shop owner on the Turkish border who was known for providing fake identifications. Hardy believed that a gang connected to the shop owner had abducted Padnos. She obtained photographs of the shop owner and the gang members and sent all this information to the FBI, along with images of a prison in Aleppo. She suspected, correctly, that Padnos had been held there. The FBI ordered her to shut down her operation. It's unclear whether the Bureau had already acquired similar intelligence on its own. Hardy concluded that the gang who had kidnapped Padnos had sold him to the highest bidder. Foley's case was more complicated. He had been taken with John Cantley, a British journalist. They were good friends, although Cantley had a reputation for recklessness. Once, in Libya, Claire Gillis told me, Cantley invited her and Foley to chase down a story in a particularly dicey area. Gillis declined, but Foley went ahead. To her relief, they returned unscathed. In Turkey, Hardy met a British security contractor who had seen Cantley just before he disappeared. Cantley had been making boorish jokes in front of a group of Syrians, and his countrymen reprimanded him for his cultural insensitivity. Cantley laughed it off. He had been kidnapped once before in Syria, in July 2012, by British jihadists. They shot him in the arm when he tried to escape. A week later, he was liberated by the Free Syrian Army. Not long after, he returned to Syria with an assignment to make a documentary about his captivity. He intended to go to the site where he had been abducted. A foolhardy trip, but actual assignments were precious. He apparently enlisted Foley to be his videographer. Within days, they had been captured. Mary Hardy had developed a theory about staying safe in dangerous places. One third is good management. How many people do I have working with me, and how many bad guys are out there? The second third is local goodwill. The last third is good luck. She faulted Cantley and Foley on all three counts. They had been spotted, filing their stories in an internet cafe, speaking English. Bad management. Cantley's crude humor, a strike against goodwill, and both men had been taken before. So their luck had plainly run out. If you go into that environment, you have to do some soul-searching, Hardy says. The macho thing is, I am willing to take the risk. But it's not just you and your freedom you're risking. A conflict journalist should acknowledge that he is also placing his institution at risk. He is asking his friends and his family to potentially stop everything while they pursue his freedom. And he is tacitly demanding that his government risk soldiers' lives if a rescue attempt is made. Not every journalist, Hardy observed, cares to be encumbered by such considerations. But at least that's an interesting conversation to have at the bar. On June 10th, 2014, ISIS forces overran Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city. Sleeper cells had carried out assassinations that left the city leaderless, and the Iraqi army quickly dissolved under assault. Because so few journalists remained on the ground to document events, the news came as a shock. The very next day, Tikrit fell. On June 29th, ISIS announced the formation of a new caliphate. In Mosul, ISIS's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, climbed the minbar of the great mosque of al-Nuri and boldly declared himself the new caliph, demanding the fealty of Muslims everywhere. Henceforth, the territory held by ISIS would be called the Islamic State. Despite the disparagement of many mainline imams, thousands of new fighters answered Baghdadi's call, animated by the vision of a restored Islamic empire and exhilarated by the savagery practiced by his followers. 50,000 Yazidis, an ancient monotheistic community north of Mosul, fled when ISIS announced plans to exterminate them. The U.S. felt rising international pressure to stop an impending genocide. Simultaneously, ISIS forces swept toward the Kurdish capital of Erbil, where American advisors and diplomats were stationed. The families of the hostages were caught in a vise. Any American action to halt ISIS's advance would likely trigger retaliation against their children. But their plight was still a secret, so little political effort was being exerted on their behalf. The White House certainly realized that intervening against ISIS could affect the fortunes of the hostages. "It weighed on everyone's mind," Ben Rhodes, a deputy national security advisor, told me. But he added, "Not to take action in confronting the potential genocide against the Yazidis would be both a failure in terms of enabling the slaughter to go forward, and also would suggest our own foreign policy can be held in check by the presence of hostages. That," he said, "would be the ultimate form of empowering the hostage taker." Meanwhile, the ransom demand for Padnos rose to 22 million euros. In July, a video of Padnos surfaced in several American embassies through intermediaries. He was seated on the floor, wrists bound, with a gun pointed at his head. "My life is in very, very, very grave danger," Padnos said. "They've given me 3 days, 3 days to live." The video had apparently been made 2 days earlier. Bradley had previously met with Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent whose skillful interrogation of Al-Qaeda members had led to the identification of the 9/11 hijackers. Soufan, who is Lebanese-American, has since founded a security company, the Soufan Group, with offices in New York and Doha. Soufan's heart sank as he learned of the hostages' plight. He doubted that the U.S. had assets on the ground, and he was well acquainted with the limitations of the American intelligence community. There was only one direction to turn. "Let's go to Qatar," he told Bradley. Late on July 10th, Bradley and Soufan were in the lobby of the St. Regis Hotel in Doha, waiting to meet Ghanem Khalifa Al-Kubaisi, the head of the Qatari intelligence service. Qatar is a conservative Wahhabi society, but it plays a confounding role in the region, hosting both the Al Jazeera network and an American airbase, for instance. Many rebel groups in Syria depend on Qatari support, but the country also provides an underground channel of communication between radical Islamists and the West. 6 weeks earlier, Qatar had arranged the exchange of the Taliban prisoners for Bo Bergdahl. It was Ramadan, the fasting month, when Soufan and Bradley arrived. A complicated time to approach government officials. Moreover, Qatari intelligence was preoccupied by the military operation that Israel had just launched in Gaza. That very evening, Kubaisi was briefing the emir. After midnight, Sufan got a call from Kubaisi's chief of staff saying that his boss couldn't meet that night. "You have to," Sufan told him. "We're leaving at 3 a.m. Kubaisi showed up at 1:30 a.m. Bradley had expected him to be a hard-boiled veteran, but he was young and soft-spoken, with warm, lively eyes. Bradley presented flyers with photographs of the captives and details about the kidnappings. Kubaisi leafed through them without much hope. "You cannot predict with these groups," he said. "They are so irrational." Yet he paused upon seeing the Padnos flyer. "I think we can help on this one," he said. Alone among the 5 hostages, Padnos was being held by Jabhat al-Nusra, an al-Qaeda affiliate that had broken away from ISIS in February 2014. The 2 factions had been battling each other since then. Although Qatar maintained influence with al-Nusra, sending an operative into Aleppo was extremely dangerous, and the 3-day deadline for Padnos had already passed. Kubaisi realized he would have to act fast if there was any hope of saving Padnos. He told Bradley, "I will do it for the mother."